Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. Joining us today is one of the world's leading experts on polling, Dr. Daryl Bricker, the global CEO of Ipsos Public Affairs, one of the world's leading polling and analysis firms. He's also a great author, and I commend, as I always do on this program, his book, Empty Planet, The Shock of Global Population Decline, which he co-wrote, and his latest is Next, Where We Live, What We Buy, and Who Will Lead Canada's Future. As in each of the past 11 years, Daryl and his team conduct a series of very thoughtful surveys to coincide with the annual Halifax International Security Forum, gauging international public support on how nations are perceived, as well as top security, economic, and social challenges. Each year, some of the world's leading international security officials, analysts, thinkers, and reporters descend on Halifax, the capital of Nova Scotia, for the forum. But unfortunately, this year's event, because of the pandemic, was held virtually, but it was still a terrific gathering. That's an honor and pleasure to cover. And I should also note that Daryl is not only a participant, but also a key advisor. Daryl, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me on, Vago.
Absolute pleasure. And I also commend our audience to listen to the great strategy conversation Daryl and I had just a couple of weeks ago about polling and the accuracy of polling in the wake of the election in the United States that astonishingly is still not quite concluded because the vote has not fully been counted because of the distributed way that we do things. Before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. And Beretta USA sponsors our land warfare coverage. Daryl, thanks again for joining us. Three great surveys. You have your annual ranking on how countries are perceived that you surveyed some more than 21,000 people in nearly 30 countries. The other survey focused on top threats that unsurprisingly included COVID. And another one that was interesting on how people want their governments to respond to this pandemic. Let's start with the ranking of nations. Congratulations. Canada continues in the lead as number one. But talk to us about some of the key takeaways of this, including two great powers that lost ground over the past year.
Yeah, it really is interesting to see a couple of things. One of them is the stability of the answers over time. So we've been doing this for, I think, about 11 years for the Halifax International Security Forum. And most of the players in the rankings stay fairly stable. We don't all just look at countries, by the way. We also look at international organizations like the United Nations. And I think we looked at the World Health Organization this time around. But the biggest mover that we saw this year was China, and it was down. So China, in terms of its position, and the question is, who will perform or be a positive influence in the world going forward? And China was at 42% of the population, the 20,000 people we interview, saying that it will perform a positive role. That's down 11 points in the space of the last 12 months. The United States is at about 50%, so it's higher than China. But back in 2016, prior to the election of the Trump administration, it was as high as 64. So both China and the United States have come down in terms of public esteem, mainly because of events. China, I would say it's a combination of what's happened with COVID, but also things that have been happening relative to trade issues, Hong Kong, maybe the way they've been treating minorities in their country. The basic news cycle on China right now is fairly negative, and you're seeing that the world population is basically being affected by that. In the United States, it was generally the effect of the election of the Trump administration. We'll see now that the Biden administration is going to be coming in, whether or not those numbers bounce back up to where they were at the time of Obama.
And having a drop in rankings like that certainly makes it easier for national leaders to confront China, right? So, I mean, it is a statistical move that at a time when, for example, the Biden administration is expected to be equally tough on China, and this time marshal its allies and partners, it certainly makes it easier to marshal those allies and partners to stand up to China, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. And one of the things, Vago, we were talking about last year when we saw the results, because remember, China was 11 points higher, basically even a little bit higher than the United States. And you really had to start asking the question, because we asked people, you know, were there elements of Chinese society that they thought would be, should be adopted by their own country, or whether there were elements of American style of government that should be adopted by their country. And we're interviewing people in 28 countries. So it's, you know, democracies and not, developed countries and not. And China was pretty competitive with the United States on some of those questions. So, you know, the question I raised back then, last year, seems so many years ago now, but last year was, you know, have we seen history reemerge? I mean, is Francis Fukuyama wrong? You know, history has ended because liberal democratic capitalism has triumphed, and it's really the only way that's acceptable or aspirational in terms of organizing human society. Maybe China is now putting another model out there, and we're going to be seeing this kind of competition going forward. But China took a really big hit this year and is not, you know, the aspirational marker that it was last year. So the question is, you know, what is its status in the world going to be? Hard to say.
That certainly is going to be an interesting trend, right? And there are those who are blaming Xi Jinping, even within the Chinese system, for saying, hey, you know, you're moving too hard, too fast on too many fronts, and you're making too many enemies, right? That we should have continued with sort of the Deng Xiaoping, bide your time, you know, lay your plan and trap, right? I mean, there are even some who say that had China, you know, waited 10 years, it would have been a very different security dynamic that folks might have been waking up to before it was too late. Alas, authoritarians regularly kind of overplay their hand. Talk to us about who also gained ground, right? I mean, the United Kingdom did well, right? How did the rest of these rankings of great nations and even international institutions move up and down on the scale?
Well, the interesting thing is they actually didn't move that much. The big movers were basically the big mover was China. That was the thing that really moved. But most of the other countries stayed pretty much within, you know, maybe a place or two in terms of where they were in the over the previous surveys, and not just, you know, year over year, but for several years. One of the interesting points that you make is that, you know, the UK went up a little bit. And one would have to say, for example, if you're sitting in the UK and you're reading a steady diet of information about what was going on there with both Brexit and the management of COVID, that you know, perhaps it would be a different situation, that, you know, international esteem is declining. And there's two, and by the way, we had another survey in which we looked at national brand indexes that we did, that we also released. It wasn't part of Halifax Security Forum. And we saw an uptick in the UK again in that survey. So it's fairly consistent. A couple of points on that. One, maybe people aren't paying as much attention to what's going on in the UK as maybe particularly people in the international policy elite think they should be. And the second thing is, isn't it interesting, given, you know, the history of the UK and how influential it's been in the past, how little attention people are actually paying to what's going on there right now?
That certainly is fascinating. It's equally fascinating that when you go to the bottom of your list, Iran is at the bottom. But just above Iran is Israel, right? One is a theocratic, you know, authoritarian theocracy, and the other one is liberal democracy. How do you find that one is at 28 and the other is, I think, at 32 or 33%?
Well, it is interesting that if you take a North American perspective, we can absolutely see why Iran is where it is. But we're hard pressed to understand why Israel is the way that Israel is. But, you know, you recognize that some of the countries we're doing interviewing in, like Turkey, people don't have a very positive view of Israel. So, or Saudi Arabia, where we also were interviewing. So Israel, while it may be seen more favorably in places like Canada and the United States, in other parts of the world, it has a real difficult reputational problem to deal with.
And let me restate, Iran was at 27%, which increased by 2%, and Israel was at 39% and increased by 3%, and then Saudi Arabia is at 42%, up 3%. Interestingly, Russia is at 46% and went up 1% at the end of the day, whereas European Union, surprisingly, is at 70% unchanged, and the UN dropped 2% at 69. NATO is at 60% with no change. Is there something you wanted to add?
Yeah, sure. So some of those places, some of the things, like, for example, NATO, well known in Europe and North America, but in other parts of the world, people don't know what NATO is. So what you'd see is, rather than people, you know, 40% having a contrary point of view, a fair part of that non-support is just people saying, I don't know, I don't really know what NATO is. And this is an ongoing issue for NATO. You know, what is its agenda, given what's happened in the, you know, the former Soviet Union, and what is its future going to be?
Let's talk about perceived threats among global citizens, as you put them. I sort of like that, right? I like the idea, Daryl. Thank you, for myself being sort of a global citizen. I, full disclosure, I didn't get interviewed for this survey. But talk to us about the threats, right? Because last year it was hacking. Any big surprise where we are? How did that list jumble up in terms of threat perceptions?
Well, again, this is something that tends to follow the news cycle. So a few years ago, we saw pandemics, which was actually fairly low, I think, last year, actually had jumped up again, and that was around the Ebola crisis. So if you want to get the public's attention and you want to get them concerned, talk to them about a pandemic, because that's when we see that those numbers start to pop. The other thing about personal, about hacking, is people hear so much about it these days that last year it was the top of the list. It's fairly close to the top of the list, actually not that far behind a pandemic. And the reason for that is because people actually believe it could happen in their own lives. They believe that their own data isn't secure. Whereas something like, say, for example, some of the other threats that we ask about, like, you know, armed conflict between your country and another country, people don't feel that that's really that possible in most places. There are some places where they do feel it's possible, like Turkey, interestingly enough, in the United States, or, different ethnic minorities squaring off in an armed conflict within a country. There's some places where people feel that. But by and large, there tend to be further down the list. The things that are at the top of the list are the things that lead the news, plus the things that you think could personally affect you. One of the other things that ranks pretty high on the list is concern about your family suffering some sort of physical violence or threat. And in North America, not really that big, but in places like South Africa or Latin America, say Brazil, it's really high on people's list. So it's interesting when we get into conversations and say, for example, we leave things aside like pandemic as a big issue, or hacking, and we ask people, you know, what are the most important issues facing the world today? What are they most concerned about? You see things like, for example, global climate change ranks fairly high, although we didn't ask it in this survey, in places like the Nordic nations, or in Canada, or even in a place like Japan. Whereas you go to developing countries, not really that high. What are they more concerned about? These personal issues of safety, corruption, and other things. So, you know, where you stand on some of these issues is really where you live. And what your personal circumstances in your country really dictates what you see as what your threats are going to be.
I still think, right? I mean, you mentioned climate, right? So 65% see it as a major natural disaster. What I thought was really interesting was the nuclear and chemical attack was still something that's 67%, down 2%, but that was still kind of surprising to see that where it was, and also how low terrorism was at 58%, down 7%.
Yeah, the places where you see terrorism ranking pretty high are places that have experienced it recently. So, for example, like France. And again, this is, you know, what's actually happening in your country dictates what people see as threats, even though we're asking them, you know, more from a kind of a global perspective, but they still see them as threats.
It's still interesting, because I think if I went to a lot of Americans and say, hey, does nuclear loom large in your mind? I would be sort of surprised if people said, like, oh, you know, that's a primary thing. So that's why it was kind of surprised me.
Well, just after Fukushima, that one went up.
Oh, I can imagine. Right. Yeah. Absolutely. Let me take you to the question of how the global citizens are responding or want to see from their governments in terms of combating COVID, because I thought that it was a little, you know, in a globalized world, that's not the answer that I would have expected, even though it should probably have not been surprising. Talk to us about the outcome of that third.
Yeah, survey. Well, 67% of the world's population, the 20,000 plus people we interviewed, said that they want their borders closed due to COVID. And why wouldn't they? Only a third of the world actually thinks that it's under control. So it is amazing to me what's happened on the COVID with the COVID pandemic. This is the first time in human history in which the entire world at just about the same time decided to do exactly the same thing, which was to, based on scientific evidence, decide to fight this one specific problem, which was COVID. And how people think that, for example, international travel, you know, global access and those kinds of things actually brings it to their shores. Interestingly enough, one of the countries that ranks highest on the list of people who want to have their borders closed, and it's in the 80s, is Canada. And the reason they want to have their borders closed is not because they're worried about Europe, but because they're worried about the United States.
Yeah, that is. So talk to us about the countries that actually are shown to have exhibited good leadership, because some of them are not surprising in terms of the countries that sort of did well stopping the virus, right? Give us your sense on that list, because it's a little, there's one country on that list that I'm not sure deserves to be there. But anyway.
Well, at top of the list is New Zealand, Canada, and Germany, followed by Sweden.
Which doesn't seem like it should be there.
Yeah, but people, I think some of it probably relates to the brand of the country as opposed to what the actual performance has been. But the really interesting one on this is this is the first time, the very first time I've ever seen New Zealand pop on anything. And it's right at the top of the list. So it shows you, if you did do a good job and are generally known as doing a good job, the public recognizes it. At the very bottom of the list, at 22% of the world population thinking they've done a good job, the United States.
China, which is second on the list, is at 44%, which is a vast difference.
Twice as good, yeah. Well, and part of that is probably explained by the fact that the Chinese think that they're doing all right, but the United States, I don't remember exactly what the number is, but I can't imagine it's higher than 50% thinking their government's doing a good job of managing the virus. So, you know, even if your home team's not on your side, that tells you how the rest of the world's probably going to react as well.
I'm lucky because I happen to have this open, Daryl, that the United States is clearly lagging the field, and even only 39% of Americans believe that the U.S. has shown leadership through its COVID-19 response. So it's even below the 50%. You know, you were being charitable as usual.
Yeah, well, I couldn't remember exactly what the number was, but I knew it was, as I said, you know, it all adds up to the same thing, which is if you can't even get your own people, it's hard to get the rest of the world.
And World Health Organization falls at 53% on that, something which obviously is being assailed here in the United States. And the United Kingdom came in at 47%. First, I commend everybody. Go to the Ipsos.com and try to find these surveys, because they're very interesting and worth reading. Any other interesting projects you're working on as this extraordinary 2020 comes to an end?
Yeah, I think the most interesting, important work that we're going to be doing over the space of the next 6 months is going to be related to vaccines. So how are governments going to manage this process of rolling out something that's so fundamental to us getting our world back on track? How are they going to make those decisions? And also dealing with the fact that there are large swaths of the population that are not convinced that they should be getting vaccines and are very concerned with the speed with which this has taken place. And it's easy to say that this is about anti-vaxxers. It's actually not that, although there is, you know, some elements of that. It really is more about what people, the amount of risk that they're prepared to take on in order to get their lives back, and really trying to understand how to work the equation. I think we've talked about this before, which is really the amount of desire that we have to get something going minus the amount of risk that's associated with it actually equals the amount of time something is going to take. So trying to figure out how all of that is going to work. And there's a lot of big questions that relate to how to talk to the public about it, but also in terms of the policy choices that governments are going to be made, what's going to be acceptable policy and what's not. That's the biggest thing, I think, at least in my activity, that's gonna really dominate the type of work we do over the next 6 months to a year.
And it's stuff, Daryl, that we would love to see, because if you think about it, right, I mean, at the end of the day, a vaccine is the most successful if you can get people to take it. If they don't take it, then there are a number of people that remain vulnerable at the end of the day. What is that baseline global American, Canadian, right? Where do populations fall? I know that it's a little bit different in each country. France, it's surprising that there's resistance to vaccines, even for a country that tends to be quite health-focused at the end of the day. What are some of the baseline numbers out there in terms of what?
It's about 60-40. So there's it's about 60-40, but the truth is, even if all 60% decided that they were going to go, so not leaving the other 40% out, if they all wanted it at once, the world couldn't accommodate it. The real question about that we're going to be dealing with is, how do you effectively cascade this important thing out to populations without really, really upsetting people, both the people that you are going to have to convince that they need to take it, but also people who are going to want it that it won't be available to immediately. So I would say for most countries, it's generally sort of a 65, 35, 60, 40 type situation. But among the 60%, it breaks down into certain groups. And among the 35, 40%, it breaks down to certain groups. Hardcore people who are absolutely resistant to getting vaccines, probably more like 10 to 15.
Let me ask you one brief question. I'm not going to ask you to betray the conversation you led about expertise at the Halifax Forum.
Sure, I don't mind talking about it.
I should note to people that there are public events and then there are closed events. And when you're at the forum, there's a series of dinners and late night chats and things like that, which makes it truly an extraordinary event. And the 300 or so people that are invited, there's an intimacy to it that some of the other conferences, having been to almost all of them, they lack, which you have at Halifax. Very quickly, what's the sense about expertise, right? I mean, expertise around the world, we talked a little bit about it when we were talking about polling, but there is this, especially in the United States, this sort of hostility toward expertise, which is really baffling, because at the end of the day, in an increasingly complicated world, expertise should be embraced. And yet the United States finds itself in the coronavirus pickle it's in, because known expertise, sophisticated planning were all discarded. And there's this sort of sense that even politicians, it's better if they're not experts, not recognizing that it's a skill set. Talk to us about expertise and what's happening regarding global views toward expertise, which may be worrying.
Yeah, so the real interesting conversation was around the line between expertise and decisions. So people who are in a position of having to make decisions on difficult issues, and how expertise plays into how they make decisions. So, where does judgment and expertise, how do they come together, was really what the conversation was about. A lot of interesting perspectives around the table. What I added to the conversation was, I think that there is a real obsession these days with a fairly, what is a really important issue, because we would like to see it as the issue when it comes to the challenge of expertise, which is the one that relates to a combination of, social media, fake news, or whatever you want to call it, and people who are just prepared to buy into conspiracy theories. Everybody can agree that that one's wrong. That's the easy one. What you do about it, that's hard, but everybody can agree that there's a problem with that. I kind of tried to steer some of the conversation back to the issue of the problem with expertise and advocacy, and how experts, when they have a point of view, tend to marshal expertise or science in particular to prove their point of view and to push an agenda, as opposed to really playing the role that an expert should play, which is, I'm going to open my mind up to all sorts of possibilities, rather than just trying to convince somebody of what a particular point of view is supposed to be and what an outcome is supposed to be. So it's not just the easy challenge of dealing although it's, I don't want to pretend it's an easy challenge. It's easy to identify and say that it's bad, which is the challenge that relates to fake news, poor expertise, social media, and that combination of toxic information that finds its way in discussions. The other one is a different kind of conversation, which is, where do you draw the line between expertise and advocacy?
What is that line?
Well, my point of view on this is that too often these days, because people feel that the way to get attention and the way to be vital and part of what's going on in society, if you're somebody who works as an expert, is to take a position and to advocate for it and to use your training and all the rest of it to achieve this particular type of outcome. And to me, that's kind of avoiding what the scientific process, or corrupting what the scientific process, is supposed to be about, which is supposed to be that you're not an advocate. Basically, what you do is, you know, if you testify at a trial as an expert, your job is to inform, the conversation that's taking place, not to advocate on behalf of your client. Otherwise, you're just somebody with an opinion. So my view on this, and I may be speaking for a small minority of people, is, experts heal thyself. I mean, if you want to be an advocate, then go do that. But if you want to be an expert, open your mind up to a whole variety of possibilities and don't be so certain about what you're saying.
Daryl, it's always a pleasure having you on. Thanks very much. Look forward to having you on, especially as vaccines come on, as well as to get your take on any one of a number of other issues. Always a pleasure. Thanks very much, sir.
Thanks so much, Fargo.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.